In 1880, Minneapolis was a blossoming city of over 45,000 people. Just 8 years had passed since the city merged with St. Anthony on the east bank of the Mississippi River, and during this short period of time, the population of the combined cities had more than doubled. Yet little had been done to bind the two parts of Minneapolis together. The main business hub of the city, like today, was located on the west side of the river, as were most of the city's flour and sawmills. On the east bank, one could find a few smaller mills, scattered shops and hotels, and less than 20% of the city's total population. What was needed in the eyes of many Minneapolis businessmen was a new bridge that would bring railroad passengers directly into the central business district of Minneapolis. To embark on such an undertaking, Minneapolis business leaders turned to St. Paul's up-and-coming railroad entrepreneur, James J. Hill. Hill eagerly plunged into the task and within a few short years managed to bring the venture to completion. Known to critics as Hill's Folly at the time of construction, the resulting bridge still stands, as solid today as it was the day it was completed in 1883. Known simply as the Stone Arch Bridge, this 2,100-foot-long, 100,000-ton structure helped usher the railroad age into Minneapolis. This, then, is the story of James J. Hill's Stone Arch Bridge, one of the most remarkable pieces of 19th-century architecture still in existence in Minneapolis. On a cold January morning in 1882, press reports indicated that ground had been broken and construction begun on the Great Viaduct. Colonel Charles C. Smith, Hill's West Point trained engineer, and Edward Dara and Michael Haviland, the contractors on the project, began work in earnest. A small crew had been hired to begin the project, and within days, Derrick's tool houses and steam-driven engines were assembled and put into place on both sides of the river.
The gentlemen comprising the firm are among the most successful and energetic railroad builders in the country, and before many days, the people of Minneapolis will be enabled to see how much can be accomplished in a short time by concentrated and well-directed energy. St. Paul Pioneer Press, January 13th, 1882.
Within weeks, nearly 600 men were at work on the project. 300 of these employed as a day crew, 125 made up the night shift. Another 125 were set to work cutting limestone blocks from a quarry on the east bank of the river. The workers were paid $1.25 a day for their labors and most certainly earned every nickel. While heavy construction has always been grueling work, in 1882 it could be brutal. February 21st of that year, the Pioneer Press noted that 20 or 30 men were busy up to their waists in icy waters. These laborers were constructing a number of cofferdams, structures in the middle of the river from which water could be pumped with steam-driven centrifugal pumps. When completed, these dams allowed workers to prepare the necessary foundations of the bridge upon the temporary dried floor of the river. While the workers were provided with great rubber boots necessary for the amphibious character of the employment, it's hard to imagine that the work was anything but torture. On February 26th, after just 45 days of work on the bridge, the first casualty occurred. Joseph Schmidt, a young Prussian immigrant, met his death in the rapids below the falls. Schmidt was helping to build one of the piers on Hennepin Island when his foreman ordered him to take a message to a crew doing similar work on Upton Island. While maneuvering a small rowboat through strong river currents, Schmidt apparently lost control of the craft and was swept into the rapids downstream. Schmidt struggled for a few moments before sinking into the churning waters. When the victim's foreman was questioned as to the wisdom of sending a lone man to navigate a tiny rowboat through such waters, the foreman retorted,
"Schmidt became thoroughly rattled and was drowned through a lack of nerve and ordinary presence of mind."
By the spring of 1882, all but one of the bridge's 23 foundations were completed, and the entire site was connected by a series of rickety wooden tramways. Horses were employed to drag huge stone blocks along these tramways, where equally rickety derricks swung the huge blocks onto the growing piers. Four sputtering steam engines provided the power necessary for some of the derricks to hoist the stone into place. But more often than not, the blocks were raised and lowered by means of horsepower. A number of windlasses were employed for this purpose, devices that permitted draft horses walking in circles to coil thick ropes around wooden drums. One of these contraptions, the bar passing through the shaft of the windlass, snapped, causing an 800-pound block of limestone to tumble into the river. The weight of the limestone caused the windlass to be spun at lightning speed, and a piece of the shattered windlass was hurled away with great velocity. The flying debris struck the operator of the device, a young immigrant named John Donovan, instantly crushing the poor man's skull. "Knocked into eternity," read the newspaper headline. By the spring of 1883, the last of the foundations had been completed and the bridge's piers were rapidly rising above the waterline. As they rose above the water, the piers curved outward on either side, forming the bridge's distinctive arches. Like any self-supporting arch, they were incapable of standing without external support prior to completion. As a result, thousands of heavy timbers were used to prop up the unfinished structures. These creaking and groaning timbers shivered under the weight of the half-completed arches. Sometimes they collapsed with tragic results. The third and final casualty on the project involved a young man who was crushed when a violent gust of wind caused the timbers holding one partially completed arch to give way. But when things went as planned and the two halves of the uncompleted arch approached very near to one another, the uppermost stone, the keystone, could be dropped into place and hammered home with huge wooden mallets. Once completed, the arches became as solid as the granite and limestone deposits from which they were quarried.
Speed is the characteristic of American civilization. Everybody is in a hurry, and no sooner is one device for overcoming time and space successfully put to use than people find it too slow, and brain and money are drawn upon to start an improvement.
So read the account in the Pioneer Press of the completion of the Stone Arch Bridge. One of the most important features of Hill's creation, it seems, was that it reduced travel time between Minneapolis and St. Paul to an astonishing 20 minutes. Because the Minneapolis-St. Paul route crossed no city streets, trains leaving one city could immediately put on full steam and rush through to the other. Even when crossing the new bridge, trains could achieve top speeds. The heavy stone walls on either side of the structure's upper deck were said to be so massive that in the event of a derailment, trains could neither jump over nor crash through them. This was quite different from most railroad viaducts. The typical railroad bridge of the day was a wobbly wooden affair over which trains literally had to creep. They were usually cut-rate structures, built of timbers felled on the spot and intended to only last a few years. Hill's Bridge, by contrast, was a 100,000-ton stone monument built for the centuries. Firmer than the earth is how the Tribune described Hill's creation. More solid than the ground itself, described the Pioneer Press. While Union Depot had yet to be completed, contractor George Brackett's shovel brigade was said to be tearing up the dirt at a brisk rate. The original plans called for a depot between Hennepin and Nicollet Avenues, but the site being prepared by Brackett's men was located on the river flats beneath Hennepin Avenue Suspension Bridge. Pedestrians leaving the new facility would climb a set of stairs and emerge from the building in the middle of Bridge Square, the very center of activity in Minneapolis. In the meantime, a temporary depot was established at the end of 4th Street, and travelers were able to step off a passenger train in the very heart of Minneapolis. The Union Depot was completed in April of 1885. The design of the building was said to be almost severe in its simplicity, but the Tribune insisted one must enter the building to appreciate its beauty, convenience, and spaciousness. The Northern Pacific Railway, the Chicago, St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Omaha Railway, and the Minneapolis and St. Louis Railway immediately joined in using the facility. Within a few years, the Chicago, Burlington, and Northern Railway, the Eastern Railway Company of Minnesota, and the Wisconsin Central Railway Company followed suit. Every passenger railroad then serving Minneapolis used Hill's Stone Arch Bridge and Union Depot with one exception, the Milwaukee Road. Although officials of the Milwaukee Road entertained the idea, they just could not bring themselves to rent space in another line's depot. Milwaukee Road officials eventually constructed a new passenger depot of their own a few blocks away. Nevertheless, the Stone Arch Bridge and the Union Depot were the pride and joy of the downtown Minneapolis business community. A group of downtown businessmen held a testimonial dinner for Jim Hill and presented him with a massive silver tray as a token of their appreciation. The tray, a 2x2 1/2 foot solid silver work of art, was inscribed with a detailed engraving of the Stone Arch Bridge. This beautiful gift was a creation of Tiffany & Company of New York City and is now part of the Minneapolis Institute of Art's permanent collection. By 1910, rail passenger service to Minneapolis had outgrown the original Union Depot, and the facility was bursting at the seams. Jim Hill's Great Northern Railway Company had become a phenomenally successful enterprise, with tracks stretching from the plains of the Midwest to the cliffs of the Pacific Coast. Hill's company agreed to provide funds for a new downtown rail terminal, but this terminal was to be utterly unlike the original. The first Union Depot was plain and utilitarian. The second was to be ornate and grand. Lofty ceilings, ornate chandeliers, huge crystal windows, polished brass doorknobs and handrails, gigantic murals of Blackfoot and Kootenai Indian powwows, and ticket and baggage agents dressed in immaculately pressed uniforms. This was the type of facility Jim Hill wanted for his Great Northern Railway, and that is exactly what he built. Completed in 1914, the Great Northern Depot was a veritable palace. The cost of the project exceeded $1,800,000, but few complaints were heard. When visiting Minneapolis, the Stone Arch Bridge and the Great Northern Depot were very often the first glimpses visitors had of the city, they were invariably impressed. During the heyday of rail passenger service, hundreds of thousands of travelers passed over Jim Hill's Stone Arch Bridge each year on their way into or out of the city of Minneapolis. A time schedule from May of 1948 shows 82 passenger trains, representing nearly a dozen rail lines, leaving the Great Northern Depot every day. Yet, by 1978, the number of departures had been reduced to just 4. Those remaining trains were operated by a single rail carrier, Amtrak. Hard times had fallen on the Great Northern Depot. The long wooden benches, once jammed with hundreds of waiting travelers, now stood empty. The elegant chandeliers were gone, and the false ceiling hid the depot's once ornate, now crumbling roof. The walls of the waiting room were painted a dingy green. The huge windows were coated with years of grime. Receipts from ticket sales simply did not justify the expense involved in maintaining this once grand structure. On March 1st, 1978, the last passenger train to cross the Stone Arch Bridge rumbled into the Great Northern Depot. A grand age had come to an end. Within months, the Great Northern Depot fell to the wrecking ball, and the Stone Arch Bridge, itself surrounded by crumbling, abandoned flour mills, fell into obscurity. When this bridge was completed in 1883, the Minneapolis Tribune had made a rather extraordinary prediction concerning the structure.
It is constructed to stand the test of time until the golden age shall arrive, when the problem of aerial navigation will have been solved and the railroads and the railroad bridges will be useless works of engineering. Minneapolis Tribune, November 23rd, 1883.
When the last passenger train pulled out of the Great Northern Depot in 1978, the areas surrounding the depot was littered with crumbling mills, out-of-use factories, and empty warehouses. The entire downtown riverfront had all but been abandoned. The old Stone Arch Bridge, once the centerpiece of the riverfront, had been fenced off, and the only people who ventured onto this once proud structure were transients looking for a secluded location to share a bottle of cheap wine and local teens looking for a private place to engage in mischief. Yet over the last 25 years, the Minneapolis riverfront has seen a remarkable rebirth. It began with the River Place and St. Anthony Main redevelopment projects. Soon, Nicollet Island was rehabilitated. A new Hennepin Avenue suspension bridge was built, and modern hotels and condominiums have sprouted amidst the old mill ruins. The Stone Arch Bridge mutely witnessed the changes. Finally, in 1994, the Minneapolis Park Board acquired the bridge, rehabilitated it for pedestrian use, and once again made it the proud centerpiece of the downtown riverfront. Today, staff members from the new Mill City Museum offer guided walking tours across the bridge, as well as to the adjacent Mill Ruins archaeological site. Educational programs are offered to people of all ages, informing them of the significance of St. Anthony Falls, the Old Mill District, and the Stone Arch Bridge of the city of Minneapolis. Thanks to the preservation miracle pulled off by the Minneapolis Park Board, it seems more than likely that not only our grandchildren, but our grandchildren's grandchildren may one day stroll across the Mississippi River on Jim Hill's Monument to the Railroad Age.